Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 11, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call to recap the oral argument of the Supreme Court case Pena-Rodriguez v. Colorado. My name is Laura Flint. I'm an assistant director of practice groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome our expert, John C. Richter, partner at King & Spalding. After our speaker makes his opening statements, we'll open the floor for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us, John. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Today, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in the case of Pena-Rodriguez versus Colorado. The specific question before the court is whether the Sixth Amendment right to a fair and impartial jury compels the creation of an exception to a state evidentiary rule that mirrors Federal Rule of Evidence 606B that generally bars attempts after a verdict to impeach that verdict based on allegations of misconduct by jurors, in this case to account for allegations of racial bias by a juror. In the case, the Colorado Rule of Evidence 606B, like its federal counterpart, prohibits a juror from testifying as to any matter or statement occurring during the course of the jury's deliberation, or to the effect of anything upon his or any other juror's mind or emotions as influencing him to assent to or dissent from the verdict or indictment or concerning his mental processes. The rule is sometimes referred to as the no impeachment rule, and this rule was recognized in England and in the United States at common law as early as the 17th century. It's been codified at the federal level much more recently by the Supreme Court and Congress and embodied in Federal Rule of Evidence 606B, which was codified in 1975. More recently, the court in Tanner versus the United States in 1987 and then 2 years ago in Warger versus Showers has upheld 606B as consistent with the Sixth Amendment. In our federal system, however, for many years had first at the state level a minority of states that have recognized limited exceptions to their no impeachment rules, holding effectively that in extreme circumstances, like evidence of a blatant use of race by a juror in considering guilt or innocence, a defendant may seek to challenge the underlying basis of the verdict. Specifically in this case, Pena-Rodriguez was convicted of unlawful sexual assault with a 16-year-old girl and harassment based on illegal physical contact with the 16-year-old and also with a 14-year-old girl that was with her. The jury considered the evidence but was unable to reach the verdict on a felony charge of attempted sexual assault on a child, which required proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Pena-Rodriguez took a substantial step toward knowingly touching the 14-year-old's intimate parts. The 14-year-old testified, however, that although Pena-Rodriguez had touched her shoulder, he had not grabbed her breast. So the jury acquitted on the felony charge. After the verdict and the jury was dismissed, defense counsel in this case spoke with the jurors, and two jurors reported that another juror had made racially biased statements during the deliberations. The state trial court then gave defense counsel permission to receive the jurors' contact information and to obtain their affidavits. The two jurors reported that another juror, labeled in the case as under the initials HC, had made four different offensive remarks that showed substantial prejudice by that particular juror against Mexican men. And, of course, the defendant and petitioner in this case is of Mexican origin. The petitioner then moved for a new trial. The trial court denied that motion based on Colorado's no impeachment rule. And then on appeal, that was upheld both at the Colorado Appellate Court of Appeals and at the Colorado Supreme Court. The Colorado Supreme Court affirmed the trial court's decision, holding that the application of the no impeachment rule did not violate the Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury. And the court reasoned that existing Supreme Court precedent, including the Tanner and Warger cases, as well as earlier cases, stood for the principle that protecting the secrecy of jury deliberations was of paramount importance, and that protecting the finality of verdicts and ensuring full and frank jury deliberations and promoting jury independence and preserving confidence in the jury system itself outweighed a particular defendant's interest in seeking an exception when a defendant had other ways to preserve their Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury, ways such as in voir dire, in questioning jurors prior to their selection, in exercising strikes to take as part of jury selection, as far as ensuring instructions by the court that would ensure impartial consideration of the evidence in the case and consideration of the law, and policing of other misconduct that might be raised and brought to the attention of the court before the verdict is rendered. Today at the Supreme Court, then, petitioner obviously challenged the Colorado Supreme Court's reasoning. Arguing for the petitioner was Professor Jeffrey Fisher from Stanford, and he made a number of important points. First, he argued that many court jurisdictions at the state level allow for inquiry post-verdict of a jury verdict without some parade of horribles occurring. Secondly, that in this case, the petitioner was asking for a racial bias exception and that any other potential exceptions were not presented for the court. Third, that race is unique in our history. And that, as Mr. Fisher put it, quote, racism has been the stain on our entire judicial system, unquote. And that the court had recognized race-based exceptions and the unique nature of racial bias under its 14th Amendment jurisprudence, and that that had not led inexorably to a multitude of other exceptions on other bases that swallowed other criminal rules or procedures, and therefore that while this case was about the Sixth Amendment, the values underlying the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause should infuse the court's thinking with regard to the application of the Sixth Amendment in this context. Now, during Mr. Fisher's argument, he was pressed pretty hard by the Chief Justice and Justice Alito about why race was really different in the context of ensuring a fair and impartial trial. They pressed him about the fact that the court in earlier cases, for example, had denied prior challenges to the no impeachment rule where other great misconduct had occurred. For example, where a juror had been drunk and used drugs during the deliberations, where a jury had decided the case allegedly based on a coin flip. And these justices were asking why it would be more appropriate to create a racial bias exception dealing with the unfairness, potential unfairness of a verdict, but not for these other circumstances when obviously those gave rise to a high likelihood that the verdict was not reached in a fair and impartial manner. Justice Alito and the Chief Justice questioned the difficulty of line drawing in this context and were raising really the question of if you create an exception for racial bias, how do you not essentially undermine the entire rule for other misconduct that rendered the verdict questionable? They asked the question as to whether it would essentially run counter to common law notions of federalism and the Supreme Court and Congress's rulemaking in balancing the competing interests as have been done before. And that notion of line drawing was not just unique to the Chief Justice and Justice Alito. As Justice Kagan put it, everyone is afraid of opening the door. Colorado, in turn, was represented by Frederick Yarger, the current Solicitor General in Colorado, and he tried to reinforce the points that the Chief Justice and Justice Alito had been trying to make in pressing petitioner's counsel. Mr. Yarger, in turn, was pressed by Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, and Kennedy. Justice Kagan asked him questions about how extreme would be enough to become an exception. Justice Kennedy asked him if this were a capital case, whether the racial bias exhibited by the one juror would be a basis for a post-verdict challenge. Mr. Yarger gamely said no, it shouldn't be. Justice Ginsburg asked him why voir dire was enough to protect impartiality, as she made the point that many lawyers don't ask about race or won't ask about race because they don't, for fear that they will put race into the thoughts of jurors. Mr. Yarger, in my judgment, handled that particular question deftly, noting that social science, at least as quoted in their briefing, suggested that express questions designed to encourage people not to rely on biases have a tendency to make people seek to overcome their actual and implicit biases. The amicus in the, at oral argument was the United States Department of Justice, which was represented by an assistant to the Solicitor General. Rachel Carver, on behalf of the United States, argued that race has not been treated differently from other forms of misconduct under the Sixth Amendment jurisprudence, and that the creation of an exception would incur substantial costs for the criminal justice system. She also reiterated the four factors underlying the balance that had been struck by the Supreme Court and Congress in enacting the no impeachment rule at the federal level. Number one, that voir dire of potential jurors would and could mitigate any racial bias risks. Two, that jury reporting reporting about juror misconduct before a verdict could also mitigate and ensure an impartial process. Three, that an exception could extend that any exception would be indistinguishable from religious or sexual orientation or other biases, and that therefore that this was effectively a slippery slope to undercutting the entire rule itself. And then five, then, that notions of federalism should dictate that the rule not be imposed through constitutional jurisprudence, but rather could be done, obviously, simply on a state-by-state basis as each state saw as just. Now, Justice Breyer interjected during Ms. Corver's argument on behalf of the United States. He noted that the parade of horribles and that it was feared by imposing this post-verdict questioning of the verdict hadn't been seen in the majority of states that had an exception to the no impeachment rule. That he noted that he hadn't heard of any swamping of those state courts with lots of litigation. Ms. Corver deflected that by pointing out that the courts and Congress had always recognized that seeking new trial is different than other contexts in the criminal justice process because of the need for finality, the need to avoid jury tampering and harassment of jurors, and the need to essentially have confidence that a jury's verdict is worthy of credence. She emphasized that the court and Congress had balanced competing interests, and that states had also done so, and that not creating an exception in this case would still leave it open to states to create exceptions if they chose, as a minority of states have already done. And this was, of course, the federalism point present in this case. Ms. Korver then acknowledged that in the context of capital cases, the Eighth Amendment might yield different considerations, and that concession then was seized on by Jeff Fisher, petitioner's counsel, in rebuttal. He noted that all the parties are seeking a balance, to balance these competing considerations. But if structural considerations could be recognized under the Eighth Amendment when looking at the Sixth Amendment, then structural considerations also should be recognized with regard to the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause on the Sixth Amendment. And he emphasized that where inappropriate racial consideration infuses a case, there must be, and the court must impose, a constitutional failsafe, and that racial bias can never be the lesser of evils. In this case, there was very active questioning by the members of the court. While the nature of the questions to some degree highlighted the respective corners from which each of the justices were coming at the problem, they clearly were all struggling with a case in which all the parties agreed the juror had engaged in misconduct and showed inappropriate racial bias. And, of course, for even those justices who seemed to lean towards trying to find a way to not create an exception to the rule, it clearly didn't feel good to be doing nothing about it based on this record. But as they say, of course, hard cases can make bad law. And the justices were also concerned about the implications of creating an exception, as it would seemingly open doors to additional issues to be decided. So I think that's the a fair summary of what happened today. Obviously, there should be a decision will by the end of this term, and it's not easy to see exactly or self-evident exactly how the court ultimately will come down on it. But I think the court and the questions raised clearly illustrated that none of the justices see this as an easy decision.
All right. I will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. And while we wait for our first question, I'll ask one of my own, which is, what will happen if the court goes for the petitioner versus what will happen if it goes for the respondent?
Well, I think if the court goes for the respondent, we'll be left with the current state of affairs, which is that there is at the federal level, there is a split in authority in the circuits as to whether a racial exception to Federal Rule of Evidence 606B is recognized, and if so, when it can be triggered. At the state level, you'll have a minority of states that still maintain various types of exceptions to their no impeachment rule, and then a majority of states that take the broader view of their no impeachment rule. So those differences will remain depending on the jurisdiction. If the court goes the way of the petitioner, it seems most likely that the court would create a racial exception to federal rule of evidence, or in this case, it would reverse the Colorado Supreme Court's decision and suggest that there needs to be an exception to the Colorado rule 606B, which in turn would necessarily mean that the federal rule and any other state in the union that had a no impeachment rule that did not allow for a racial exception post-verdict to create one, at least essentially by virtue of the decision. I think what will follow then, and what the court was struggling with, is that decision will necessarily open doors to additional issues that will be litigated in the future. First, the fundamental question of other types of biases and misconduct, and when those may or may not trigger the need for an exception. For example, will the exhibiting of religious bias, for example, trigger the need to against a defendant, a clear religious bias against a defendant, trigger the need for an exception? The second question will be, what is the proper test or standard for judging when the racial exception or other exceptions might need to be triggered? Thirdly, whether harmless error could apply. In other words, whether the bias of one juror is structural such that no amount of weighing of the other evidence or the decision-making by other jurors could outweigh essentially that one juror's bias, or whether, in fact, that bias, when coupled with overwhelming evidence of guilt, would essentially be deemed to be harmless error, such that the case would not need to be retried. But undoubtedly, any time an exception to an existing rule, particularly one that allows for challenges after a verdict is put into place, there is going to be an impact on the criminal justice system across the several states and federally. You know, each year there are a few hundred thousand cases that are tried, and obviously that means a few more hundred thousand jurors who participate in it, and some small percentage of those jurors then would be pulled into the mix in some fashion as a result of post-verdict questioning that might occur under a rule should the court go the petitioner's way.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for a question to queue, a brief programming announcement. Our next scheduled telephone conference call will be tomorrow on Wednesday, October 12th at 12 noon. We will host a conversation with Danielle Farber, Kristen Hickman, Jim Tozzi, and Adam White on the need for an administrative law curriculum in law schools. Remember to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls, and you can always consult the full schedule of our upcoming telephone conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. And please visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you might have missed. And I see our first question, so let me transfer it to him. Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question.
Yeah, hi. This is Bill Otis. Thank you, John, for this report. My question is whether any of the justices who seemed inclined toward the defendant's point of view sketched out a theory under which there could be a limitation, that is, once a racial justice challenge is allowed, did any of them were liberal justices say, well, the way we might cabin this and screen off gender-based challenges, or a juror who says, well, you know, I don't believe Mormons, or I don't believe atheists, or I don't believe Baptists. Or a juror says, well, that witness looked transgender to me, and I think those people are too strange. Did any of the justices say what principled basis could be used to screen off challenges like that?
No, they didn't, Bill, and good question. I think that is the thing that even the justices who seemed, at least through their questions, more inclined to be sympathetic to the petitioner's cause. As Justice Kagan put it, everyone is afraid of opening the door. They asked a number of questions of Jeffrey Fisher on behalf of the petitioner, but he was not able to articulate a clean methodology for drawing a line between race and anything else. Justice Ginsburg asked whether nationality would be included. Essentially, it was conceded that, yes, sort of national origin and race were sort of one and the same for purposes of this exercise. The question of there was a fair amount of give and take on what the court has done in the past with regard to 14th Amendment jurisprudence, particularly in the context of jury selection, and the fact that for purposes of jury selection, the court has cabined the limitations really to race and gender, but not moved beyond that. But there was no articulation really of a principled basis for why you would stop necessarily at race, other than the repeated assertions that race is different historically and unique to the American experience, and has been treated differently by the court historically. But it was necessarily conceded, I think, by all the justices that there could be other and had been other kinds of misconduct that were just as unfair as racial bias might be for a particular defendant in a particular case, in terms of rendering the ultimate verdict unfair and violative, at least in spirit of the Sixth Amendment, if not in spirit of the no impeachment rule that existed.
Okay, thank you very much, John.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. But not seeing any more questions, do you have any closing remarks, John?
No, I don't think I do. Obviously, I'm happy to answer questions if someone thinks of something after the fact. I can be contacted at my law office as necessary.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank John for joining the call. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum tomorrow, Wednesday, October 12th at 12 noon. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.